Howdy, regulars. This is Regular Dispatch 25. It's June 3rd, 2020. The Five Mysteries of Capital. The key problem is to find out why that sector of society of the past, which I would not hesitate to call capitalist, should have lived as if in a bell jar, cut off from the rest. Why was it not able to expand and conquer the whole of society? Why was it that a significant rate of capital formation was possible only in certain sectors and not in the whole market economy of the time? Fernand Braudel, The Wheels of Commerce. The hour of capitalism's greatest triumph is its hour of crisis. The fall of the Berlin Wall ended more than a century of political competition between capitalism and communism. Capitalism stands alone as the only feasible way to rationally organize modern economy. At this moment in history, no responsible nation has a choice. As a result, with varying degrees of enthusiasm, third world and former communist nations have balanced their budgets, cut subsidies, welcomed foreign investment, and dropped their tariff barriers. Their efforts have been repaid with bitter disappointment. From Russia to Venezuela, the past half decade, this was written in 2000, by the way, or at least copyright 2000. The past half decade has been a time of economic suffering, tumbling incomes, anxiety and resentment, of starving, rioting, and looting. In the stinging words of Malaysian Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad. In a recent editorial, the New York Times said, for much of the world, the marketplace extolled by the West in the afterglow of victory in the Cold War has been supplanted by the cruelty of markets, wariness towards capitalism, and dangers of instability. The triumph of capitalism only in the West could be a recipe for economic and political disaster. For Americans enjoying both peace and prosperity, it has been all too easy to ignore the turmoil elsewhere. How can capitalism be in trouble when the Dow Jones Industrial Average is climbing higher than Sir Edmund Hillary? Americans look at other nations and see progress, even if it is slow and uneven. Can't you eat a Big Mac in Moscow, rent a video from Blockbuster in Shanghai, and reach the internet in Caracas? Even in the United States, however, the foreboding cannot be completely stifled. Americans see Colombia poised on the brink of a major civil war between drug trafficking guerrillas and repressive militias, an intractable insurgency in the south of Mexico, and an important part of Asia's force-fed economic growth draining away into corruption and chaos. In Latin America, sympathy for free markets is dwindling. Support for privatization has dropped from 46% of the population to 36% in May 2000. Most ominously of all, in the former communist nations, capitalism has been found wanting, and men associated with old regimes stand poised to resume power. Some Americans sense, too, that one reason for their decade-long boom is that the more precarious the rest of the world looks, the more attractive American stocks and bonds become as a haven for international money. In the business community of the West, there is a growing concern that the failure of most of the rest of the world to implement capitalism will eventually drive the rich economies into recession, as millions of investors have painfully learned from the evaporation of their emerging market funds. Globalization is a two-way street. If the third world and former communist nations cannot escape the influence of the West, neither can the West disentangle itself from them. Adverse reactions to capitalism have also been growing stronger within rich countries themselves. The rioting in Seattle at the meeting of the World Trade Organization in December 1999, and a few months later at the IMF World Bank meeting in Washington, D.C., regardless of the diversity of grievances, highlighted the anger that spreading capitalism inspires. Many have begun recalling the economic historian Karl Polanyi's warnings that free markets can collide with society and lead to fascism. Japan is struggling through its most prolonged slump since the Great Depression. Western Europeans vote for politicians who promise them a third way that rejects what a French bestseller has labeled la horreur économique, the economic horror. These whispers of alarm, disturbing though they are, have thus far only prompted American and European leaders to repeat to the rest of the world the same wearisome lectures. Stabilize your currencies, hang tough, ignore the food riots, and wait patiently for the foreign investors to return. Foreign investment is, of course, a very good thing. The more of it, the better. Stable currencies are good, too, as are free trade and transparent banking practices and the privatization of state-owned industries and every other remedy in the Western pharmacopoeia. Yet, we continually forget that global capitalism has been tried before. In Latin America, for example, reforms directed at creating capitalist systems have been tried at least four times since independence from Spain in the 1820s. Each time, after the initial euphoria, Latin Americans swung back from capitalist and market economic policies. These remedies are clearly not enough. Indeed, they fall so short as to be almost irrelevant. When these remedies fail, Westerners all too often respond not by questioning the adequacy of the remedies, but by blaming third world peoples for their lack of entrepreneurial spirit or market orientation. If they have failed to prosper despite all the excellent advice, it is because something is the matter with them. They miss the Protestant Reformation, or they are crippled by the disabling legacy of colonial Europe, or their IQs are too low. But the suggestion that it is culture that explains the success of such diverse places as Japan, Switzerland, and California, and culture again that explains the relative poverty of such equally diverse places as China, Estonia, and Baja California, is worse than inhumane. It is unconvincing. The disparity of wealth between the West and the rest of the world is far too great to be explained by culture alone. Most people want the fruits of capital, so much so that many, from the children of Sanchez to Khrushchev's son, are flocking to Western nations. The cities of the Third World and the former communist countries are teeming with entrepreneurs. You cannot walk through a Middle Eastern market, hike up to a Latin American village, or climb into a taxi cab in Moscow without someone trying to make a deal with you. The inhabitants of these countries possess talent, enthusiasm, and an astonishing ability to wring a profit out of practically nothing. They can grasp and use modern technology. Otherwise, American businesses would not be struggling to control the unauthorized use of their patents abroad, nor would the U.S. government be striving so desperately to keep modern weapons technology out of the hands of third world countries. Markets are an ancient and universal tradition. Christ drove the merchants out of the temple 2,000 years ago, and Mexicans were taking their products to market long before Columbus reached America. But if people in countries making the transition to capitalism are not pitiful beggars, are not helplessly trapped in obsolete ways, and are not the uncritical prisoners of dysfunctional cultures, what is it that prevents capitalism from delivering to them the same wealth it has delivered to the West? Why does capitalism thrive only in the West, as if enclosed in a bell jar? In this book, I intend to demonstrate that the major stumbling block that keeps the rest of the world from benefiting from capitalism is its inability to produce capital. Capital is the force that raises the productivity of labor and creates the wealth of nations. It is the lifeblood of the capitalist system, the foundation of progress, and the one thing that the poor countries of the world cannot seem to produce for themselves, no matter how eagerly their people engage in all the other activities that characterize a capitalist economy. I will also show, with the help of facts and figures that my research team and I have collected, block by block and farm by farm, in Asia, Africa, the Middle East, and Latin America, that most of the poor already possess the assets they need to make a success of capitalism. Even in the poorest countries, the poor save. The value of savings among the poor is, in fact, immense. 40 times all the foreign aid received throughout the world since 1945. In Egypt, for instance, the wealth that the poor have accumulated is worth 55 times as much as the sum of all direct foreign investment ever recorded there, including the Suez Canal and the Aswan Dam. In Haiti, the poorest nation in Latin America, the total assets of the poor are more than 150 times greater than all the foreign investment received since Haiti's independence from France in 1804. If the United States were to hike its foreign aid budget to the level recommended by the United Nations, 0.7% of national income, it would take the richest country on earth more than 150 years to transfer to the world's poor resources equal to those they already possess. But they hold these resources in defective forms. Houses built on land whose ownership rights are not adequately recorded. Unincorporated businesses with undefined liability. Industries located where financiers and investors cannot see them. Because the rights to these possessions are not adequately documented, these assets cannot readily be turned into capital, cannot be traded outside of narrow local circles where people know and trust each other, cannot be used as a collateral for a loan, and cannot be used as a share against an investment. In the West, by contrast, every parcel of land, every building, every piece of equipment or store of inventories is represented in a property document that is the visible sign of a vast, hidden process that connects all these assets to the rest of the economy. Thanks to this representational process, assets can lead to an invisible parallel, assets can lead an invisible parallel life alongside their material existence. They can be used as collateral for credit. The single most important source of funds for new business in the United States is a mortgage on the entrepreneur's house. These assets can also provide a link to the owner's credit history, an accountable address for the collection of debts and taxes, the basis for the creation of reliable and universal public utilities, and a foundation for the creation of securities like mortgage-backed bonds that can then be rediscounted and sold in secondary markets. By this process, the West injects life into assets and makes them generate capital. Third World and former communist nations do not have this representational process. As a result, most of them are undercapitalized. In the same way that a firm is undercapitalized when it issues fewer securities than its income and assets would justify, the enterprises of the poor are very much like corporations that cannot issue shares or bonds to obtain new investment and finance. Without representation, their assets are dead capital. The poor inhabitants of these nations, 5/6 of humanity, do have things, but they lack the process to represent their property and create capital. They have houses but not titles, crops but not deeds, businesses but not statutes of incorporation. It is the unavailability of these essential representations that explains why people who have adapted every other Western invention, from the paperclip to the nuclear reactor, have not been able to produce sufficient capital to make their domestic capitalism work. This is the mystery of capital. Solving it requires an understanding of why Westerners, by representing assets with titles, are able to see and draw out capital from them. One of the greatest challenges to the human mind is to comprehend and to gain access to those things we know exist but cannot see. Not everything that is real and useful is tangible and visible. Time, for example, is real, but it can only be efficiently managed when it is represented by a clock or calendar. Throughout history, human beings have invented representational systems, writing, musical notation, double entry bookkeeping, to grasp with the mind what human hands could never touch. In the same way, the great practitioners of capitalism, from the creators of integrated title systems and corporate stock to Michael Milken, were able to reveal and extract capital where others saw only junk, by devising new ways to represent the invisible potential that is locked up in the assets we accumulate. At this very moment, you are surrounded by waves of Ukrainian, Chinese, and Brazilian television that you cannot see. So too are you surrounded by assets that invisibly harbor capital. Just as the waves of Ukrainian television are far too weak for you to sense them directly, but can, with the help of a television set, be decoded to be seen and heard, so can capital be extracted and processed from assets. But only the West has the conversion process required to transform the invisible to the visible. It is this disparity that explains why Western nations create capital and the Third World and former communist nations cannot. The absence of this process in the poorer regions of the world where 2/3 of humanity live is not the consequence of some Western monopolistic conspiracy. It is rather that Westerners take this mechanism so completely for granted that they have lost all awareness of its existence. Although it is huge, nobody sees it, including the Americans, Europeans, and Japanese, who owe all their wealth to their ability to use it. It is an implicit legal infrastructure hidden deep within their property systems, of which ownership is but the tip of the iceberg. The rest of the iceberg is an intricate man-made process that can transform assets and labor into capital. This process was not created from a blueprint, and it is not described in a glossy brochure. Its origins are obscure. and its significance buried in the economic subconscious of Western capitalist nations. How could something so important have slipped our minds? It is not uncommon for us to know how to use things without understanding why they work. Sailors used magnetic compasses long before there was a satisfactory theory of magnetism. Animal breeders had a working knowledge of genetics long before Gregor Mendel explained genetic principles. Even as the West prospers from abundant capital, do people really understand the origins of capital? If they don't, there always remains the possibility that the West might damage the source of its own strength. Being clear about the source of capital will also prepare the West to protect itself and the rest of the world as soon as the prosperity of the moment yields to the crisis that is sure to come. Then the question that always arises in international crises will be heard again. Whose money will be used to solve the problem? So far, Western countries have been happy to take their system for producing capital entirely for granted and to leave its history undocumented. That history must be recovered. This book is an effort to reopen exploration of the source of capital and thus explain how to correct the economic failures of poor countries. These failures have nothing to do with deficiencies in cultural or generic heritage. Would anyone suggest cultural commonalities between Latin Americans and Russians? Yet in the last decade, ever since both regions began to build capitalism without capital, they have shared the same political, social, and economic problems. Glaring inequality, underground economies, pervasive mafias, political instability, capital flight, flagrant disregard for the law. These troubles did not originate in the monasteries of the Orthodox Church or along the pathways of the Incas. But it is not only former communist and third world countries that have suffered all of these problems. The same was true of the United States in 1783, when President George Washington complained about banditti, skimming and disposing of the cream of the country at the expense of the many. These banditti were squatters and small illegal entrepreneurs occupying lands they did not own. For the next 100 years, such squatters battled for legal rights to their land, and miners warred over their claims because ownership laws differed from town to town, camp to camp. Enforcing property rights created such a quagmire of social unrest and antagonism throughout the young United States that the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Joseph Story, wondered in 1820 whether lawyers would ever be able to settle them. Do squatters, bandits, and flagrant disregard of the law sound familiar? Americans and Europeans have been telling the other countries of the world, you have to be more like us. In fact, they are very much like the United States of a century ago, when it too was an undeveloped country. Western politicians once faced the same dramatic challenges that leaders of the developing and former communist countries are facing today. But their successors have lost contact with the days when the pioneers who opened the American West were undercapitalized because they seldom possessed title to the lands they settled and the goods they owned. When Adam Smith did his shopping in black markets and English street urchins plucked pennies cast by laughing tourists into the mud banks of the Thames. When Jean-Baptiste Colbert technocrats executed 16,000 small entrepreneurs whose only crime was manufacturing and importing cotton cloth in violation of France's industrial codes. That past is many nations present. The Western nations have so successfully integrated their poor into the economies that they have lost even the memory of how it was done. How the creation of capital back when, as the American historian Gordon Wood has written, something momentous was happening in the society and culture that released the aspirations and energies of common people as never before in American history. The something momentous was that Americans and Europeans were on the verge of establishing widespread former property law and inventing the conversion process in that law that allowed them to create capital. This was the moment when the West crossed the demarcation line that led to successful capitalism, when it ceased being a private club and became a popular culture, when George Washington's dreaded banditti were transformed into the beloved pioneers that American culture now venerates. The paradox is as clear as it is unsettling. Capital, the most essential component of Western economic advance, is the one that has received the least attention. Neglect has shrouded it in mystery. In fact, in a series of five mysteries. The mystery of the missing information. Charitable organizations have so emphasized the miseries and helplessness of the world's poor that no one has properly documented their capacity for accumulating assets. Over the past 5 years, I and 100 colleagues from 6 different nations have closed our books and opened our eyes and gone out into the streets and countrysides of 4 continents to count how much the poor sectors of society have saved. The quantity is enormous, but most of it is dead capital. The mystery of capital. This is the key mystery and the centerpiece of this book. Capital is a subject that has fascinated thinkers for the past three centuries. Marx said that you needed to go beyond physics to touch the hen that lays the golden eggs. Adam Smith felt you had to create a sort of wagon way through the air to reach the same hen. But no one has told us where the hen hides. What is capital? How is it produced? And how is it related to money? The mystery of political awareness. If there is so much dead capital in the world and in the hands of so many poor people, why haven't governments tried to tap into this potential wealth? Simply because the evidence they needed has only become available in the past 40 years as billions of people throughout the world have moved from life organized on a small scale to life on a grand scale. This migration to the cities has rapidly divided labor and spawned in poor countries a huge industrial commercial revolution, one that incredibly has been virtually ignored. The missing lessons of U.S. history. What is going on in the Third World and the former communist countries has happened before, in Europe and North America. Unfortunately, we have been so mesmerized by the failure of so many nations to make the transition to capitalism that we have forgotten how successful capitalist nations actually did it. For years, I have visited the technocrats and politicians in advanced nations from Alaska to Tokyo, but they had no answers. It was a mystery. I finally found the answer in the history books, the most pertinent example being that of U.S. history. The mystery of legal failure, why property law does not work outside the West. Since the 19th century, nations have been copying the laws of the West to give their citizens the institutional framework to produce wealth. They continue to copy such laws today, and obviously it doesn't work. Most citizens still cannot use the law to convert their savings into capital. Why is this so, and what is needed to make the law work remains a mystery. The solution to each of these mysteries is the subject of a chapter in this book. The moment is ripe to solve the problem of why capitalism is triumphant in the West and stalling practically everywhere else. As all possible alternatives to capitalism have now evaporated, we are finally in a position to study capital dispassionately and carefully. That's chapter one of The Mystery of Capital by Peruvian economist, still living, Hernando de Soto. Fantastic book. It fits after reading Webb's Introduction to the Great Plains, about that period of time when Anglo-American citizens on the eastern seaboard kept venturing west, and also the opening to Peter Zeihan's The Accidental Superpower, about the geography and geopolitics of America. This book was written in 2000. Hernando de Soto has an international focus, and therefore, I don't at all hold it against him that he's comparing the, quote, success in the West with less success in other places, and hopefully pointing out to the West what they're not appreciating, what they're not seeing, what they take for granted. Now, this week seems a very apt moment in time to also reflect on how so many of these layers in this representational system that help assets become capital have been denied to various people inside the borders of this country, the supposed bastion of capitalism. There's so many layers to it, redlining and credit and access to venture capital and opportunities and even more fundamental things such as education and housing. In this framework outlined by Hernando de Soto, used very convincingly to compare one national system to another national system, can also be applied inside a national system to uncover what's wrong inside and how capital is being unnecessarily and wrongfully impeded. Connecting these ideas in this rope that we are winding here to Julian Simon, it is also clear that falsely deadening capital diminishes us all, even those of us to whom it does not happen directly, because, as Julian Simon very convincingly argues in The Ultimate Resource 2, the ultimate resource isn't wheat or air or water or oil or energy. It's human ingenuity and imagination. And how do we unlock those ideas? Prove them, test them, feed what works, scrap what doesn't, go again. We do not deaden our capital. And it's also, I've mentioned just in passing Eleanor Ostrom and her work to examine the commons. And she has this beautiful idea that rather than sitting in a, quote, lab as an economist, decrying one side of this false dichotomy, in her case, the idea, her critique, what she didn't like was this story that to manage this common pool of resources, we have two choices. An ineffective, calcifying, corruptible, institutional, centralized bureaucracy, or rapacious, wild, greedy, corrupt private interest. And the, quote, tragedy of the commons, which is was sort of a fictional tale. Her idea, brilliant, and she won the Nobel Prize for this work that she undertook with her husband and that brought in that synthesized and organized the work of hundreds, if not thousands, of researchers. Again, very reminiscent of DeSoto here, talking about hundreds of economists going and actually looking in the world to see what are the assets held by the global poor. And they're immense in the extreme. In Ostrom's case, what she did is gathered from many different disciplines existing research completed on common pool resources. She also came up with her own taxonomy and framework for organizing this research, like a shorthand, a notation. It's incredibly academic and pretty brilliant, and concluded, you know what? Actually, the world's a lot more interesting and complex. There's so many, this dichotomy is false. There aren't two modes. There's this interplay, and she kind of created this, her own framework, eight things that help us categorize how common pools are actually managed out there in the world. So DeSoto and team going out to look and see what's really there and recording it and bringing in good data is beautiful. For what it's worth, too, in that whenever it was in the past dispatch when I talked about Ostrom, I think I was also talking about Ronald Coase, and I was talking about how his work on transaction costs, he won the Nobel Prize, and he also studied externalities and was brilliant. But the nature of the firm, where he's talking about every transaction has a cost, he came to those conclusions, too, by asking himself, wait a minute, what's actually happening out there in the world? Let's go look at what's actually happening out there, not just a theory without evidence. And very interestingly here, just touching into chapter 2 of DeSoto's book, The Mystery of Capital here, every chapter begins with a cutout quote, and chapter 2 begins with a quote from Ronald Coase, from apparently his book, The Task of the Society, or his paper, The Task of the Society, which I have not read, but here's the quote. Economics over the years has become more and more abstract and divorced from events in the real world. Economists, by and large, do not study the workings of the actual economic system. They theorize about it. As Ellie Devins, an English economist, once said at a meeting, if economists wished to study the horse, they wouldn't go look at horses. They'd sit in their studies and say to themselves, what would I do if I were a horse? So I love that in general. I this moment in time, right now, every night, there's a massive amount of desperate anger and disappointment and rage and being expressed. That's a gigantic subject. Where these dispatches do at least converge with that a bit is we're working our way towards, we're just sort of each day just talking through little things here and talking about each person's individual agency to be creative, to share what you're thinking and working on and go build your success. And things like history and geography, there are all of this stuff around us that it's so easy not to see. And now here we are too with an economist talking about how there's so much. Julian Simon is talking about wealth as knowledge and the dissemination of that knowledge that builds real wealth. And DeSoto is talking about physical assets, wealth in physical form. And there is so, so much of it. In what I read earlier, he focuses on the global poor, 5/6 of the world's population that has all of this existing wealth, but it lacks the representation to function as capital. It's deadened through no fault of their own. By the way, we'll get to it someday, I would imagine. DeSoto, I think it's fair to say, is also what his thesis here is suggesting, is that this is a unintentional accident, that it's invisible, this representational layer. It's disappeared into history, that there used to be, quote, squatters and competing rights, and now we have clean title and all these layers in the U.S. that took over 100 years for that to develop, and that it's an innocent, unintentional accident that this has occurred. There are also many arguments that it is, in fact, quite intentional. And the Confessions of an Economic Hitman, as an example, comes to mind. Perhaps I'll need to bring some of that into the mix here. But the idea that debt, sovereign debt, the IMF, a lot of these organs, the World Bank, are used intentionally as tools of subjugation and control. And that's also incredibly, that must be wrestled with. We're going to have to go through that. And clearly, inside this country, there have been vast efforts from education, the vote, housing where you can live in a town, access to banking and credit, and all of these layers. It was not, it has to be said, it was not merely an innocent, oops, we didn't see this was happening, accident. It was a policy goal. It was a policy goal. Part of what I'm arguing is there is a clear economic incentive for each of us to give a damn. Hopefully you give a damn already. It's the right thing to do ethically. In addition, this whole thing is an infinite game. It's not a finite game where we're arguing over a fixed pizza and who gets how much. We can make more pizzas. This is an infinite game. No one should want at any level in any jurisdiction deadened capital. The solutions to today's problems are going to come from all over the place. And the way we ensure that that happens faster and better is we clear this junk out of the way in between each individual and their ability to go participate in the world. We'll keep down this thread. July 4th is coming up. There's going to be a lot of fun stuff to read related to that. going to I've wanted to get through these last 3 days of Webb, Zihan, DeSoto, just to put their ideas on the table. We're occasionally going to dip back down into fun Austin stuff, Texas stuff, and useful things about each of us, and the tools we all have at our disposal. We're going to be bouncing all over the place, but the thread is, I am starting to feel like as I'm doing this, that there's a regular code that's emerging, and I kind of like that feeling. So we'll see where it goes. For now, I'll close. Thanks, y'all.